Or to put it in other words, we need a new bottom line. If the old bottom line is maximize money and power for the interest of the powerful, the new bottom line says that if you want a definition of rationality, if you want a definition of productivity, if you want a criterion of efficiency, it's this: not only how much money or power you make, but how much love and kindness you generate, how much ethical and ecological sensitivity you generate, how much you can generate a spirit of love and caring for the other. How much does this institution or this piece of legislation enhance our capacity to see the other as an embodiment of the sacred and enhance our capacity to respond to the universe with awe and wonder and radical amazement at the grandeur of creation? Now, many liberals, when they hear this, say, wait a second, awe and wonder and radical amazement, that's all that religious stuff. That has no place in the political arena. What is that? Why is that in politics? And here, some in the liberal world have become First Amendment fundamentalists. They are correct in fighting to preserve the First Amendment against the encroachments of those who want to bring a specific religion and establish a specific religion. But they are wrong to push all spiritual values out of the public sphere and to claim that that's what the First Amendment is about. It's not. There is no way that one can fight for the kind of world that we need without a clear spiritual foundation and a clear spiritual articulation. So we need to turn to our liberal and progressive brothers and sisters and say, let's look at the most powerful, the most successful articulator of our vision in the 20th century, Martin Luther King Jr. And what do you see from that? You see that the vision comes straight out of the churches, the African-American churches. It is rooted in a spiritual vision of the world. Martin Luther King Jr. didn't come and try to convince everybody to convert to Christianity. He wasn't trying to impose his specific religion, but he was building...
part of a hierarchical order and concept. Then you babble that people who challenge some of this hocus pocusism are First Amendment fundamentalists. Talking about the spiritual values, it's wrong to push it out of the political sphere. Equality, justice, environmentalism, the justice and rights of the slaves are not a claim the spiritualists can claim that we're about to unfold. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check this. You're listening to 103.3, 101.1 in Santa Cruz with Skid, 104.1 Berkeley, 96.3, 106.7, LUVER.com, the world, radioforall.net, the universe. Click into a couple of slave affiliate sites, propagandapress.org, savagejustice.blogspot.com, of course. flavorvoteradio.blogspot.com. Find out what time it really is. Tonight, we're going to go beyond some of these shadows and deal with the mindset and the hierarchical beliefs of Abraham's children. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3. Slaver Vote.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
Institutionalization of one's mind and soul into the hierarchical beliefs of the privatized state is a factor in dominating the masses. The rulers of all of these decrepit societies know this. This is one of the key reasons that religions, a hierarchical concept and construct, is such a valuable tool to the world's imperialists. In this Beyond the Shadow segment called Abraham's Children of War, Genocide, and Imperial State Colonialization, Israel and Sudan, Slave Revolt addresses this topic of the imperial myth-making apparatus and justification and demonization by the true believers, and how this deadly toxic, often this racist brew, play out on the world stage. Now first, let's start off with Zina al-Khalil. She's from Lebanon. And she is talking about the recent savage bombardment by the State of Israel against the Lebanese people and how this is portrayed and absorbed. So let's check out what she has to say. Take this.
From the beginning, this war on the media has been televised as a war against Hezbollah, but in fact it is way beyond that. They are not just targeting Hezbollah centers, they are mostly targeting civilian infrastructure, and by targeting civilian infrastructure, you are targeting civilians. For example, we have had food storages hit, wheat silos have been hit, power plants, telecommunication towers, people can't call each other. In the south, there's no way to reach anyone. And yesterday, they hit a tower in the north. There's no way to reach anyone. You know about the airport that's been hit, gas storage, fuel storage. So basically, what's happening now is there's no way for people to communicate. It's becoming harder and harder. As they hit more telecommunication towers, it's getting harder to communicate with people who are in areas where they are stuck or trapped. Major roads and major bridges have been hit. So trucks, even if we did have trucks with medical supplies, can't get to these people. And even if they did, let's say, somehow go with very small cars, taking back roads up and down the mountains until they finally get to the city, there's no way of knowing exactly what they need and being able to give them what they need. Presently, our biggest issue is the fear that already food supplies are running very low, medical supplies are very low, and because all our borders are shut, we and any aid that's been trying to get through has been targeted, we're not being able to get this aid to people, even if we could. A few days ago, a vehicle sent by the United Arab Emirates was blown up. It was carrying medical equipment. A friend of mine, an American friend who was able to escape through the Syrian border a few days ago, told me when she crossed the border, there were so many first aid trucks from Kuwait, medical aid trucks parked, waiting to be allowed to get in. So the crisis is on all levels. It's internal. We can't get to each other. We can't call each other. The people who are trapped or stuck in their villages can't leave. A few days ago, the Israelis informed people that by dropping flyers and through phone calls that they should evacuate the south because they were going to begin heavy shelling. But when people did try to evacuate, they were being targeted. A convoy of about 20 cars were hit, and I can't tell you how many civilians were massacred, mostly women and children. So even if people did try to leave to get help, they can't. And even if we do try to send them help, we can't. So it's not just a national. It's not just a crisis. It's all. Dare I say, it's a genocide cleansing.
Which goes hand in hand with state imperialism. As the rulers, the players, the privatizers within these particular societies look for ways of expanding their power base for their own monopolistic control within their society. But one of the key factors that one often sees how many of these demonic dogs are able to dehumanize other people is through the hierarchical institutions of religion. If one looks when Khalil was talking about how Israel's war goes beyond Hezbollah targeting. They're targeting the civilian population, food stores, telecommunications, airports, fuel storage, so on and so forth. Now, as many of us slaves know, and as I went over in the previous show concerning the empire spreads its wings, how Israel and other imperialists are really after resource control, because if one can control the life energy blood of the world's resources, that's a key factor in you imperializing on a dominating stage other competing privatized state institutions. Yet you really don't hear the average slob just come out and say, this is what we're doing. They often have to dehumanize other portions of the population and inject a form of solidarity amongst their population in a particular identity. In the case of Israel, we know that that has a lot of its roots into the Jewish identity. The Jewish state of Israel is often what you hear these guys say. The whole concept of a greater Israel, which is tied, of course, with the Jewish state, which under this type of hierarchical privatized institution, which is what the rulers are really after. This means bold imperialism. But a key factor in them gelling portions of their population together is under this hierarchical ideology of we as a special people under the command, under the wing of God. Now, in the same case that you see in the Sudan, you have a situation where the Sudanese government, the Khartoum government, the National Islamic Front, Bashir and company, they've been targeting a civilian population. Civilian populations. They've been doing everything they can to undermine the autonomy and sovereignty of the population. They often attack people's basic needs to survive. And in the same way that we've seen in the case of the Lebanon situation, where massive migration of the civilian population takes place in Darfur, we've seen the same thing. Now, what the clique in Sudan is really after is preservation of their privatized power and a control of resources. Now, since you have a situation where the majority of the population, the indigenous population, does not see itself as Arab, that basically means that there's a problem, because the Sudanese government in power sees Sudan as an Arab state. Yet the majority of the population's orientation is not in that mode. A large portion of the population, especially in the south and Nuba Mountains, is not orientated towards Islam. So here you see the process of the Islamicization tactics and the Arabicization tactics of the ruling order. Now, of course, they say this is to civilize the population. But in reality, under the tradition of the Abrahams, that means basically to control the population, to take away their worldview, their way of land distribution, their historical story, their particular languages, their identity, their concept of what it means to be a human being on earth, and replace it with an hierarchical construct that fits right within the privatized state's apparatus of a monopoly for the few, crumbs and dust for the many. Now, what's fascinating is that many Arabs all around the world can see the barbarity and contradictions that the Lebanese and Palestinians are going through under the brutality of the Israelis. And they rightfully challenge Israel's claim under the banner of religion, their construct of a Jewish state. Yet, when it comes to the Christopher Columbuses with turbans, beards, and hijabs, the self-proclaimed Arab identityist in control in Sudan, the whole script gets flipped on its head. Here you have a people with Arabic identity and of Islam beliefs who are not indigenous to the Sudan. The Sudan was Nubia. Nubia was occupied and destroyed by invaders, occupiers, you know, kind of like what Israel has been in the process of doing, and is still in the process, even though there's a quote-unquote ceasefire. but there's never truly a ceasefire for privatized imperial state apparatus. Mongols. Never. Unless they're put to rest. So, here you have a situation where in the state of the Sudan was quote-unquote created out of the blood of the indigenous people. And you've had, since the deployment and control of various Arab clique factions, the continuation of an attack on the majority population to change their identity, religion, and worldview. Now, that's because this is how you can control the people, the masses. This is how all imperialist states have always done this. Khalil talks about how Israel was involved in creating a situation where food and medical supplies were running very low. We've seen this in Fallujah by the Christopher Columbuses with cowboy boots. And of course, we've seen this in the Sudan, Christopher Columbuses with turbans. She then talked about how the Israelis have told the people to evacuate the south. And then when they did do that, they got hit. Think about it. Sam told the Iraqis to evacuate on that highway of death of Kuwait. And when they did, Turkey shoot. Sudan has been telling the Darfurians, the black ones, to go back home. And when they do, even if they don't, mass extermination, hundreds of thousands killed. And as she summed it up, it's a form of ethnic cleansing. Ethnic cleansing goes hand in hand with the erasure of a people's story. In the Americas, the saying was, kill the Indian, save the man. And that meant what was needed against the Aboriginal population was to Americanize and Christianize that population. In America, in the Sudan, and in parts of Africa, we've seen the process of the Arabicization and Islamicization of the population, which is to steal the story and erase the ethnic, racial lineage of that people. It's all about a land grab. America, Sudan, wherever these hierarchical institutions exist. But they know very well that one of the greatest apparatus to do this is under the banner of an invisible man in the sky. Now here we have Robert Brecker. He's an editor for Mideast Report, and he talks about the comparison between what the Jews went through in Europe and what the Jewish state is now doing to the Lebanese people. Check this out.
No, I haven't heard anybody invoking the Holocaust or anything of that nature ever since the conflict broke. People have been wondering for quite some time, how could a people who has suffered so much inflict this kind of damage on other people? And the, you know, people here feel that at coming out of the particular history which you've talked about, that they have a special and sacred right to security. And that's in the, and when they feel like they have a right to absolute security, because at a certain point in their history, they were absolutely insecure. But the problem with the demand for absolute security is that it's a recipe for tyranny. When you ask for absolute security,
absolute security would justify dropping a nuclear bomb on a city because one person has a rifle there. I mean, what the Israeli government has been saying, the rhetoric it's been using throughout this crisis, is that we cannot have a threat on our border. And so it talks about Hezbollah and also Hamas that way, and also Syria to a lesser extent that way. That it's not just the physical aggression that is the problem. It's the very fact of a threat in and of itself, which must be neutralized. And since any living being can be a threat, that's when you pose your demands in such a way, you create a recipe for great violence.
Now, for the imperial states, they always want the population to feel that they're under threat. All one has to do is look at Sam's plantation and the propaganda that's being put out. Now, we slaves know that there's another agenda. And this is in part what I'm trying to point out, the lineage of these other agendas of these various hierarchical religious state institutions, and even some that don't call themselves religious but use religion, like Boy George, as a way of justifying, in the name of a higher order, their imperial aggression. Now, when Becker talks about how, in Israel, there's often talk about how we cannot have a threat on our border. The Darfurians, who, even though they're Islam, have an African orientation and the historical lineage to Africa, their orientation is basically within the continent. Whereas Bashir, the president of the Sudan, who got into power in 1989 by a coup because there was a peace treaty, because it was ripping the country apart, and this particular clique that wanted power and preservation of power did not want to share in the country's wealth, and saw that by maintaining the traditional Arab domination over the majority of the indigenous population as being the classic vehicle of maintaining the power and control over the whole population, because the whole population would be in a continuous war where the monopolist can engage the state in the continuous war-making apparatus to pulverize the masses in the name of, keeping stability. But really, it's a process of maintaining power and extracting out the extreme wealth and resources for the few. But Bashir, the president's slogan is Arab nationalism, Arab unity. So where does that leave the indigenous black masses? Under the hooves of the occupiers, of the flesh traders. That's how they came in, flesh trading. Now, the Dinkas in the south, the Nuers, the Nubas in the Nuba Mountains, and more, furs on and on and on, have always been in a constant battle with the Arabic population, because of how the Arabic population has tried to impose on them their belief systems and their construct of how one is to operate under the state authority of those in power. Now, when you have populations like the Nuers, who have historically had, over time, evolved their thousands of years old society into a more or less an anarchist type of society, and their concept of land, property, quote unquote, and all of that is radically different. than those who want to privatize energy, control oil, control water, etc., etc., then of course that click in power is going to want to change the fabric of one's these particular populations' identity. So in essence, it's the classic situation where those who want to maintain a privatized order need to discipline their populations. And one of the tools of disciplining their populations is through these hierarchical Abrahamic religions. When Henry Ford went to Brazil in the 1930s, basically to start a rubber plant tree, rubber plant operation in part of the Amazonia, they set up a situation where the populations were going to be working for Ford in this kind of Ford Wonderland in the Amazonia. And one of the core things that Ford and them established were Christian-based schools. And they often talked, especially the captains of industry, about the Americanization of South America, of Mexico, the Christianization. It went hand in hand with the missionary process. And it wasn't just an abstract idea. It's because when you have indigenous populations and transported African populations whose worldview and whose way of habit as far as work and survival have more or less evolved concerning their particular environment, often it comes in conflict with those who are there to maximize profit and maximize the exploitation of one's labor. So they want you up at a certain time, on time, working X amount of hours per day to maximize their profit off of you. Now, the fact that working under these types of conditions in the most blazing type of heat, you know, in the middle of the day and all of that stuff, will often wear someone down and create all kinds of problems where they find themselves checking out of existence of this planet early, means nothing to the privatizers because the masses of people are expendable. They just get the next slave in. So, but if you have a different concept and you have not been indoctrinated within this type of privatized hierarchical world order, you're going to come in conflict with this, which is exactly what happened, which is why Henry Ford and them were pushing these Christian schools, because the Christian schools parlay the whole concept in many ways of privatized hierarchical state worldviews, which is the authority, the dominator, you being a servant under these orders. This is how religion, these hierarchical Abrahamic religions, play themselves out. To submit. To be dominated. For you to bend your life into the folds of the captains, the rulers, the gods, the preachers, the imams, the priests, the popes, the commandos, commands. So, conflict was continuously sparking out. And if one looks at the progression of how the captains of industry tried to and did penetrate into South America, and I'm just using this as one example, you'll see also the Christianization and the attempts of Christianizing the population go hand in hand. And it wasn't, like I said, just because they just had some kind of overzealous worldview of how great Christianity would be and how much better people would be off. They knew that this is a controlling mechanism of the minds and souls of many of the population. So when you see how the Americanization process and the Christianization process has played out in the Americas and the attempts at it, one can also see that, like in Darfur right now, when you hear about the rapes taking place, these aren't just guys just quote-unquote dominating women just to dominate them because they have the gun in a position of power. There's a political social aspect to this. They're trying to Arabicize the population, because under their concept, if a male the kid is what the male is. So if the male is Arab, then the kid is Arab, regardless of the background of the mother. So this massive rape is a way to try to ethnically cleanse and change the character of the population, which fits right within the social control apparatus of the clique in power that knows that it has contempt for the masses of the black population, that it feels is superior to. It feels it has a right to dominate, and will use whatever means available to do it. Now here Becker talks about the perpetual violence in states like Israel and the militarization of its culture. So let's check this out.
We're looking at the fruit of six decades of militarization of culture, and by this point that way of responding to things has become very deeply ingrained here. The whole language of deterrence, right? The idea that people need to be scared of Israel and that will be a way to ensure peace. That is very, very deeply rooted here, even though as anybody can see, that has not worked. And when people claim that they need deterrence, that really is another way of saying we want to use military power to solve our political problems. And that hasn't worked.
Well, in many ways it has, at least up until now, because what we have is all state structures are designed to maintain the monopolization of riches, resources, etc., for the few while subjugating the masses. At the same time, disciplining the masses for the military subjugation of others outside of its borders. The state itself is part of the militarization of the masses. It's part of the control lean apparatus of the slaves and subjects for battle for the few at the expense of themselves. It's designed, the state apparatus is designed to dominate and create hegemonic authoritarian power throughout the planet. So the whole concept and construct of the state apparatus is in part designed to civilize, quote unquote, the masses, which means to discipline the masses under the agenda of a particular elite. in control, whether it's a secular state or a religious state. It all equals out to the privatized control and dominance of the economy and its resources. Religion, these hierarchical religions, have helped form the identity of the state, is what I'm saying. If you look at, you know, in many ways, the Islams gave birth to Christopher Columbus. The Islams conquered Spain and indigenous people and ruled them for 800 years. They had in a religious state apparatus controlled and dominated by the Moors. Now it took, in this particular case, a Christian revolution, that's basically what it was, a Christian revolution to overthrow the Islamic Moor dominance of Spain that lasted for 800 years. Now what the average Islam, especially a lot of these Negro Islam types, they'll like to focus in on the Moors' quote-unquote contribution. The fact that they invented eyeglasses, the fact that they invented aspirin and all of that. But the reality is that all human beings under the right condition can create, you know, monumental structures and make progress in mathematics and calendars, and have from the New World in the Americas, throughout Africa, of course, throughout the Middle East, and of course throughout Asia, India, you know, all these places. So the fact that the Moors were able to, you know, make some technological contributions and medical advancements is really not that big of a deal. Human beings have that capacity anywhere in the world under the right conditions and stuff. But what was ingrained in the Spanish culture was this type of religious imperial state furor. The Spaniards, even today, burn effigies of Muhammad, because for them, you can go down there and once a year they have this celebration where they have a giant thing of Muhammad and they burn it, because Islam represented for them occupation, colonialization, domination of them. Now, since in part they responded with kind of their own hierarchical religious revolt, which is a hierarchical response within itself. It wasn't a true or healthy, from a slave's perspective, a slave revolution per se. In other words, they weren't anti-imperialist or anti-colonialization or anti-occupation. They just didn't want it to happen to them, which is pretty traditional amongst many Abrahams. They don't like occupation when it happens to them, as we see in the Arab world, quite correctly, but when the Arab world is engaged in doing the same thing, like in the Sudan, they look the other way. Well, what happened in Spain was, in Spain, they finally kicked out the Moors in 1491. 1 year later, 1492, Christopher Columbus sails the ocean blue. He used the tools, the technology that he got primarily from the Moors, and applied it, instead of within an Islamic imperial mode, his brother, he did it in a Christian imperial mode. And the New World and the world in general has never been the same. So, is this civilized? Is this civilization? In other words, at a certain point in time, us slaves have to challenge the concept of what these Arab, these Abrahams call civilization. You know, when they talk about class of civilizations and all of this type of stuff, I'm really not quite sure I go in for this civilization stuff from a slave's perspective of the Abrahamic world. Christian societies and world developments, Islamic ones, Hebronic ones, have been a continuous process of privatized institutions, dominance, imperialism, expansionism, in the name of God. But nevertheless, who benefits from this? A privatized clique elite, even though it's in the name of God. But as we slaves know, on the ground, it's humans who bear the fruits of these so-called changes and developments within these particular societies. In other words, it's just human beings who carry out and who are going to be living in the grand buildings built by the slaves, and it's just another group of human beings who are living in the slums and in the huts. Now, they can say that this is the Pope is just the carrier of God, and this is in part why he lives high off the hog. But at the end of the day, it's just human beings that the slaves see who benefit and who are under the crushing hooves. There is no God on the ground orchestrating this out. In essence, what I'm saying is, these are human-made constructs designed to benefit the few at the expense of the many. And as long as we have these hierarchical institutions, the elites know that there is always going to be permanent conflict, permanent war. That so-called peace, so-called peace, is only temporary at best, and that the future only holds more conflict and destruction on the grand chessboard game. Now, here next is Norm Solomon talking about how certain religions sanctify the destruction of others and how human suffering at the hooves of the beast is depicted. And he's saying this in reference to the recent issue that has been transpiring, of course, within Israel and Lebanon.
We have seen, you know, some depictions of the human suffering, and I think we'll see quite a bit more, but then that is put in a context of, look what Hezbollah, Iran, Syria made Israel do. And so the culpability gets shredded through the way in which the story is framed, and that's certainly accentuated by the kind of commentaries we get and don't get. A lot of the silence is the most powerful, and of course that's replicated through Capitol Hill, it's replicated through some of the left in the United States, where if this bombing was underway through the direct aegis of the Pentagon, there would be a lot more uproar. But even if you look, say, at Paul Krugman's column on Sunday, he talks about the crazies in the Bush administration, but he only refers to what's going on with Israel's attack on Lebanon as, quote, the current crisis on the Israel-Lebanon border. And so the underlying, usually unarticulated but implicit lie that a religion can sanctify certain attacks and make some deaths tragic and others insignificant, I think that's at the core of some of the silence or understated response. It is simply a belief that Jews or Christians or whoever sanctified by the U.S. government in alliance with Washington that their lives matter a lot more. And this is kind of an ugly underlying dynamic that we have yet to directly challenge, certainly not sufficiently.
But this is something that has gone on within all three of the Abrahams. See, this is what I'm pointing out and how that fits right in within the tool of the imperialist state apparatus. Religions of the Abrahamic tradition organize the masses into an imperialistic formation. Submit to leadership. Submit to authority. Expansionism is for the good of humanity. You know, free trade and all these little cliches and so on and so forth. Dissent internally is blasphemous. Whether you're talking religion under the Abraham tradition or anti-American under the whole nationalistic Fuhrer. You know, if you descend on the issue of Israel and you're Jewish, you're anti-Jew. If you descend under what's going on in Sudan, Mauritania, whatever, you're anti-Islam. You know, if you challenge the slave trading history of Islam's, then, you know, they try to play the same little game. All of them do it. So when Solomon talks about how the implicit lie is a religion can sanctify certain attacks and make some deaths tragic and other insignificant, this has been part of a tradition. It's been at a constant state of war. You know, in a 1716, a guy named Thomas Pello was captured by Islam's, taken off to Morocco, and he wrote manuscripts about his experience. Millions of whites were enslaved in these particular regions by Islam's. You know, the Islam's would often say, you know, they're having a war on Christianity and use this as a pretext to raid. Now, basically, a slave trading, flesh trading, is energy trading, you know, and so the capture of a slave is a capture of a form of energy. And the privatizers who want to control as much energy as possible have always been embedded into this particular tradition. We see it in all different forms now. That's in part what this other high form of energy wars is about now, with natural gas and hydrocarbons. It's a form of energy. And since they're privatizers, they are going to battle over who can monopolize the control and distribution of this particular energy. Under the same pretext, Pello and many white slaves found themselves in under the hooves of the flesh peddlers, under the Sultan Maulay Ismail. If one looks into this history of white slave trading, one sees the manuscripts and pictures of extreme forms of torture of the white slaves to get their compliance. They were forced to wear heavy chains, like 50 pounds on an ankle, on one of the ankles and stuff. They were set afire to and publicly executed, basically to get the other slaves and subjects to comply to the authority. The whole white flesh slave trading by the Islam really didn't end until the region of like Algiers had to surrender, basically through war, because they basically had lost major battles with the rising power in the European theater and stuff. That's what really brought it to an end. So many of them even turned more ferociously against towards black people, but that's a whole nother story and stuff. And one I've gone into, you know, the Zanj, Z-A-N-J, and the whole flesh trading and major war that took place, or major resistance by the black slaves in the region that is now called Baghdad, that lasted for over 15 years. against the Islamic flesh traders who carted them off from the eastern part of Africa into the Middle East as property and stuff. So my whole point is that these battles and traditions have taken place, and the viciousness that the slaves, the white slaves, were under by the Islam, it was very similar to what black slaves faced under the Hoos in the Americas. Because basically you've had privatized our control over a population, and they wanted to extract as much profit out of that. So the white slaves found themselves working 15 hours a day under brutal conditions, cutting stones and, you know, kept in underground dungeons and so on and so forth. I mean, I know there's like this kind of myth, which has always been kind of amazing, of the benevolent slave trading going on by the Islams. And it is a myth. Because there is no such thing as benevolent slavery. Slavery is a form of genocide. It is a form of crushing of one's culture, of one's language, of one's identity, changing one's story, often crushing their religion and replacing it with another one, that of the slavers. This is not a coincidence in any way. This is done intentionally. So, for control of that population. So, there's this like illusion going on, and a removal of why populations are exploited, and how these hierarchical religions are part of a tool of that exploitation. Now, in 1995, the Southern Baptist Convention apologized for their churches promoting slavery. This is in the Americas. Now, what was this all about? Basically, the church, this Baptist church in the South, and we're talking major church institutions that penetrated all throughout the South and gave the South its particular identity. In 1845, defended slavery as biblically sanctioned. And the Confederacy itself was closely linked to this whole particular apparatus. Their whole program was part of the South was a sacred nation. The Civil War, crusaded by the South, was a holy crusade. In the DeBow Review in 1860, their comment was, quote, "Many causes will contribute to our happiness as a separate nation, but preeminently in view stand two particular features. The one is pure religion, the other is a perfect legal system. In religious sentiment, the South stands as a unit. Its pure doctrines are linked inseparably, though not by legal constraint, with the laws of the land. Christ is acknowledged as the common bond of union." Unquote. So basically, you just had them fusing their imperialistic religion, Abrahamic religion, in this case Christianity, to the whole goals and privatized controlling mechanisms of the rulers in the South. This is how easily they blend together. These crusaders know this. All Abrahamic crusaders know this. Now, Solomon also talked about how, he goes, how things are depicted, you know. And he stated how Israel is always predicting things like human suffering is depicted as, look what Syria Or look what Lebanon or Hezbollah made us do, made Israel do. Now, when you look at what's going on in the Sudan, you see that same type of thing. Look what the Darfurians by rebelling, even though they're oppressed. Look what they made us do. Look what the Afros in the Nuba Mountain made us do. And on and on. Sam, of course, says, look what the whole Middle East made us do. And throws terms out there about their particular identity as that being the reason why they're invading. When we know it's about control. But they use these things as a pretext to justify sovereign people's annihilation. The game is played by the Abrahams, the same all over the planet. Now, here's Maxime Kusia. He's written the book called Sharing the Land of Canaan. Here, he's also part of the Palestinian Rights to Return in North America. It's like a coalition, an organization. Here he talks about the theft and conquest and ethnic cleansing by Israel of its inhabitants. So let's check out what Maxim has to say. And let's broaden it out from here. Check this out.
Yes, I'm actually a co-founder of the Palestine Right to Return Coalition in North America, and it's dealing with the right of refugees to return to their homes and lands. We have always asked the Lebanese government and argued with Arab governments that they should give Palestinian refugees full equal rights in those countries and give them what international law requires of hosting countries for refugees, equal opportunities at jobs and so forth. In other words, we don't excuse the Lebanese government for what it does with regards to the Palestinians. However, as you pointed out, the issue is not what the Lebanese or the Kuwaitis or the Jordanians who are hosting these refugees do to them. It is the more important issue is why are these people refugees and why are they there and why are they denied a basic and inalienable right to return to their homes and lands from which they were expelled. And by the way, continue to be expelled. The ethnic cleansing didn't stop with the establishment of the State of Israel. I just came back from Palestine, and by any conservative estimates, this year there will be at least 30,000 to 60,000 Palestinians made homeless by Israeli policies of ethnic cleansing, removing people, taking over their lands, building walls on their lands, and so forth. So this process has never stopped, and it continues, and it is funded and supported by us, the taxpayers here in America. So I think, you know, that has to be put in perspective.
And one of the perspective things need to be put in is that, in essence, in part what I'm saying, I should say, is religions are institutions of compliance. Institutions of submittance to a higher order. That higher order is interpreted by human beings. That hierarchical order is dominated primarily of men in power and influence, economic privatized power and influence. Preserving these hocus-pocus belief systems maintains certain men's dominance and influence within these structures for those who submit to this system, and as long as they exist, even for the slaves who are resisting these hierarchical institutions. So it's all part of a controlling apparatus, and it fits right within the whole state apparatus. This is not a coincidence. So why are they refugees? Because of the whole privatized institutions and how they are fomented. So whether we're talking about the refugees in Palestine made and created by the State of Israel, or the 2 million refugees in the Darfurian region made and created by the state of the Sudan. But what's fascinating is how many people of particular faiths turn a blind eye when it's people of their faith doing the imperializing, the dehumanizing, the refugeeizing, the exterminating of other groups of people. Now here, Laura Nader talks about how the expansionist state operates. And how Israel plays into it within its own particular goals in the region. So check this out.
Expansionist states, and Israel is an expansionist state, like the one that you mentioned, often do the same kinds of things. And I grew up in 1930s remembering all the Nazis moving into Poland and arguing about their borders and so on. There are some parallels. In fact, sometimes I wonder if the nicest way to put it is that battered babies grow up to be battering parents. So they learn some things from that experience, perhaps. And the thing to look at is what does an expansionist state do? We're talking about a historical reconstruction of Greater Israel that goes from the Tigris to the Nile, as some people have described it. If you read this in the whole discussion about water, the Nile is very important for the Negev Desert. The Litani is very important for northern Israel-Palestine, and the Tigris-Euphrates, and even the Turkish waters. So if you look at it from a water point of view, you can see why people will be expanding. On the other hand, if you look at it from an American point of view, I think Anthony Nutting put it very well when he said Israel is a western beachhead in the Middle East. So it's a place where you can use, from a western point of view, to expand western interests, which, if, of course, we know in Iraq has to do with oil. So between oil and water, you've got expansionism.
Now, what's interesting about some of this aspect is that when you're talking about expansionism and how it corresponds to often a religious / ethnic identity of a greater whatever, you know, the expansion of Christianity, the Americanization / Christianity of South America, the Greater Israel, the expansion of the Arab world. You know, in 1987, Gaddafi launched on a crusade to create an Arab belt. Basically, it was supposed to slash right through Chad, go right through the Darfur region. Now, the fact that these populations were black really didn't matter to him. He started to arm all these people and created basically this war and conflict that we still see the seeds of today. But it was all in a process of creating a larger Arab world. Often when you hear various people talk about the quote-unquote Arab world, they'll include places like the Sudan and Somalia in it, even though the Somalians have never identified themselves as Arab, even though they're Muslim. And the Sudan, which, like I mentioned before, was Nubia, but the Sudan currently, the majority of the population is of African lineage and considers themselves black. African. They consider themselves African. So how is it that a population that is not the majority and is not indigenous can so bodaciously consider that self and be agreed upon by the larger Arab world as being part of the Arab world? When there was conflict in Somalia recently, or the ongoing conflict in Somalia, many of the heads of states in the various Arab world came to Sudan, of all places, to have a meeting so that they can all talk about from near view the conflict in the Arab world, which they were pertaining to Somalia as. And they had the meeting in Sudan, which they obviously consider part of the Arab world. See, this is political. What I'm in part saying is that when people get into this expansionist identity through religion, and then often through the process of a particular ethnic character, which is, it takes on a political imperialistic tone. So in the same way that the construct of whiteness is not just a particular ethnic group, it's a political mindset, and it's a political reality. Whiteness is a political construct. It was created for political economic reasons. In certain parts of Africa, Arab identity and religious identity and affiliation is a political construct and an imperialist method within that. Now, to show you how these things play themselves out in various ways, I'll break it down as far as the identity thing. Take the Americas. In parts of South America and places like Haiti, there was created a mulatto class. And if you look where the mulatto class was created, it was in areas where the black slaves were the majority of the population. In other words, you had a smaller group of slavers with guns than the overall black population. So, places like Brazil or Haiti, the black slave population was the majority population. So when the white flesh peddlers raped black women, and an offspring was made out of that, they would give that offspring special privileges. Now, it was for political reasons. It was to buffer themselves from the overall black population. Now, in North America, even though we know rape and all of that stuff was part of the American way, no mulatto class was developed. Why? Because the white population in America was always more populous than the black slave population. And their buffer has always been the gun. So they didn't need to create a political mulatto class. They had the gun. That was their political class, violence. Overwhelming violence. So what I'm saying is that, in part, the creation of some of these particular types of identities by the oppressor is in part political. Now, the Arabicization and the Islamicization process within parts of Africa is political. You can't separate religion from politics. Or when people in the name of these religions claps on to a particular ethnic identity and see that identity as a tool of dominance, that too is a political apparatus. So for many black people in the Sudan, there's a similarity of the political mechanisms of Arabic and Islamic identity that the black population in the Americas and South Americas have faced under the hooves of the forces of expansion over here. Now, here's Dar Jamil. And he's talking about the widespread bombings of civilians next by Israel on Lebanon. Let's get into this aspect and the whole character of Abraham's children as it plays itself out. Dig this.
Over the last week, I interviewed dozens of refugees on both the western border of Syria with Lebanon as well as the northern border of Lebanon with Syria. They were reporting atrocities. They were reporting war crimes carried out by the Israeli military in southern Lebanon and in southern Beirut, which is where naturally most of these refugees came from. There are hordes of these refugees. Right now, there's at least over 250,000 of them that have come into Syria thus far. And most of those that I spoke with were all saying the same thing, and that was that it was widespread indiscriminate bombing in villages. Cars full of people fleeing those villages were being attacked by warplanes as they tried to leave. One man told me of a hospital that he saw with his own eyes being bombed by warplanes in South Beirut. Another spoke of seeing an ambulance being targeted by airstrikes itself. It's really a catastrophic situation as far as the refugees go. People have left, many of them literally with nothing but the clothes on their back and what they had in their pockets at the time. So they are really left with nothing and nowhere to go. And so there's a burgeoning crisis, not just within Lebanon, but it is, of course, spilling over into Syria at a very large level.
Now, when you put this in the context of, you know, when these clowns on this plantation talk about how they're going to bring democracy to the Middle East, what basically they're saying is we're here to civilize, you know. It's just a more modern term. Now, their real motive, of course, is to occupy and dominate the land and resources. But there's a claim that these people need democratization, i.e. civilizing, which in the end means they need disciplining under our particular state authority apparatus. When the flesh peddlers peddled their way into Africa, they claimed it was to civilize. What that really meant was to discipline the population under the slave state apparatus, to be compliant slaves. This is what all of these things and institutions really mean. Religions of the Abrahamic persuasion are crucial in disciplining the population. It helps change their worldview under the hooves of the oppressor. It helps implement in a hierarchical belief system, a set of dominance by an authority apparatus, a conditioning of the mind and body under the hooves of what is supposed to be a more special order. One of the reasons why in America you often see a lot of people, no matter how bad these businesses act, get caught stealing, conniving, ripping off populations, I'm talking internally stuff, you know, is not just because a lot of Americans feel that they too are going to be rich and be able to do that. That's in part of it. But another aspect is that they believe that these institutions are better. They believe in the methodology of particular entities being in position of dominance, of being in absolute authority, and being able to write and rewrite the rules right before our eyes. This takes and has taken serious disciplining and conditioning of a population, rural populations, and for the slave is not for the embetterment. but at the crucification of the population. You heard Jamal talk about how hospitals being bombed, ambulances being bombed and targeted by Israel. We know this is exactly the same type of mode that Sam has done in Fallujah. And the cowards in power in the Sudan have engaged in the same type of process as they've had planes drop bombs on villages. They've never really had their little confederates take head on the resistant forces per se. Instead, what primarily their target is the same target that Israel has targeted and Sam has targeted under its new Salvador plan, the population in general. This is to weaken the fabric of the society as a whole, to create a collapse. And by creating a collapse, it's, then the population overall is more easily penetrated by those who seek to control a larger arena in their particular theater of imperialistic expansion. Now, here, let's hear this cat talk about some of the alleged suicide bombing and bombers and the cases that they've been involved in or alleged to have been involved in. We know this is a lot of smoke and mirror by the state. But let's listen to him as he talks about how many people feel compelled to do this type of stuff in the name of an invisible spaceman. And let us take it from there.
And it's some of those kinds of people who feel apparently drawn to, in their eyes, defend Muslims around the world from Western assault. And when we look at what British suicide bombers have said in the past, and we know about ones before the 7th of July as well, the pair who struck in Israel, Richard Reed and the shoe bomber and so on. When we look at what they say, what they keep saying over and over again is that they conceive of their actions as a form of self-defense by the global Muslim community against Western foreign policy and its brutal impact. That's how they see it. That doesn't mean it's justified, but that means that if we want to reduce their motivation to carry out these attacks, then we have to do something about these foreign policies, which are objected to by the majority of people in Britain and the United States, Muslim and non-Muslim.
Now, when he talks about how, like, you have some Muslims feel that they must defend other Muslims from the Western assault. Defending someone from Western assault is more than what's necessary. But to define it within the parameters of what the imperialists want you to define it is basically to play their game. Because we've known in the past that Sam has used those who are of Islamic faith to crush the left in many of these regions. They've created religious-based organizations to undermine alternative views and development in these arenas. They've aided cats like bin Laden and basically have had various elements like that just basically be pawns on a string to carry out their particular, meaning the imperialists, particular goals. What in essence, in part, I'm saying is that a lot of this Christian identity, Islamic identity, Hebronic identity type of stuff is based in a classless form of expression, even though at times it will look like it's fomented within a particular class expression, when it's resisting particular imperialist forces, its overall orientation is often without the real dynamic of the slave and the slavers. As we can see now, and it's always been pretty obvious, in places like Iraq, where first you started seeing Christians being attacked. Now, these were just Christians who are Iraqis, but they found themselves being attacked just because they were Christian, even though they were under the same bombs as Islam Iraqis. Then you see women being attacked. I'm not talking about women who are trying to be a part of the whole state ruling apparatus in Iraq. Anyone who does that deserves a bullet. I'm talking about those who are just happen to be women. And then these types of things help in the process of manipulation of Sam into the type of sectarian violence that he's fomenting now, because the orientation of many of these guys who are resisting is not really based off of the slave versus the slaver. Many of them have no problem being the slaver. They don't want to be the slave or being attacked as a slave. So when we see a lot of the things go on about people talking about defending Muslims from Western assault, when we know that, like in the issue with the bombardment by Lebanon by Israel, that's part of an Anglo-corporatist resource alignment that involves many states and many Muslims. The entities in power in Saudi Arabia are in alignment with this. In Turkey, it's in part an Anglo-American Turkey-Israel alliance. Now, they're after resources and control of the region, with eyes on Syria and Iran. That's where they're coming at it. They're not going, oh, is this guy Muslim or is this guy not Muslim? They're looking at it for imperialistic control. They use these hocus-pocusisms because they know that's a very good way to conscript the masses within the fold and to leave them docile, confused, and droned out for gumpified manipulation. That's one of the games that Abraham's children have always loved to play. Hold on a sec.
The Darfur situation, again, is quite interesting in terms of how they handle it. In fact, this is an outgrowth of their strategy. Initially, when they came to power, the intention was to establish an Islamic state. Since 94, in particular, and I would say in 96, when the U.S., in 98, when the U.S. began to put pressure on them, they began to pull back on the idea of implementing their initial strategy of establishing an Islamic state. With Turabi together, that strategy was very clear. But in 1999, that is December 1999, there was a split between Turabi and Bashir, the president. Turabi, in a way, up to that point, was really, as we have characterized it, the power behind the throne. He was the guy who was really running the country. Bashir was the one who was administering it. That split, in a way, created problems for the regime as to how to pursue that strategy of establishing an Islamic State. So they decided that, again, for their own survival, Darfur was raising problems for them. And the best way to deal with Darfur was that since the war in the south was interpreted as a war of religion, that is, because they want to establish or convert the south, you know, into Islam, what they were going to do in Darfur was going to be not something that can be characterized as religious, because the Darfur people are Muslims. So they want to make sure that they suppress the emerging opposition in Darfur. That is, they will oppress it under the guise of what you might call keeping peace or keeping the Sudan together. But really what was behind the Darfur genocide is an ethnic character that took the form that it has become so clear, in fact, to many of us. That is, since the full people are African, and what was emerging actually was emphasizing the idea of Africanness, namely the Sudan Liberation Movement and the Justice Party, which, I mean, the two organizations that emerged basically to fight the Khartoum regime, were in their thinking linked to SPLM, connected in fact with the movement in the south. So they were afraid that if this could take roots in Darfur, well, this can in fact emerge as a problem of Africans against the Arab clique in Khartoum, namely the minority. That figure, I think, is very important in the thinking of this regime, as well as any northern political leaders. They've been aware of the fact that they are a minority and the Africans constitute the majority. And so they wanted to prevent the fools from basically developing that idea they are Africans. They wanted them actually to think as Muslims people. And so the killing took the form of expressing that ethnic fear that they had, that if the poor people went like the SPLA, then it is going to be very difficult for them. So what did they employ? They employed, of course, the People's Defense Forces, which, again, in Darfur, we refer to them as the Janjaweed, you know, the evil ghosts, as it is interpreted. The Janjaweed are members, in fact, of the Sudan, of the People's Defense Forces, which is created by the regime. And the idea was to suppress this opposition in Darfur by all means, if it means, in fact, carrying out genocide. And the strategy behind that, or the person who was behind that strategy, is the present second vice president, Ali Taha. Ali Taha is, in fact, even though he's the one who negotiated the peace agreement with late John Garang, is the brain behind this regime in terms of the strategy in Darfur. Some of you might have heard of a list of 51 Sudanese officials, as well as members of the Janjaweed, which has been collected by the United Nations mission to Darfur. That list of 51 people is stopped by the number one on that list is Ali Taha, the vice president then and now, the second vice president at the present. And the last, supposedly number 51 at the bottom, is the president of the country, Bashir. So you can see that the whole of this regime strategy is to suppress any opposition, but they will give in, you know, they will give here and there in order to continue to be in power. See the double game that they are playing. That is, they want to suppress the Fulus people, but at the same time also they want to say, yeah, we are ready to negotiate. So this is how they have been able to fool, in fact, the rest of the world, the international community. Now, a poll has been recently taken in the South, supposedly. I haven't seen it yet. But this was supposedly conducted by the USAID. And again, one can raise, you know, questions about how authentic that might be. The poll indicates that 96% of China Sudanese would vote for secession. Now, I do agree with that. I do agree with the overwhelming sentiment in the South for secession. Remember, let me remind the listeners that since 1983 to the present, 2 million people have died in the South, and the world, of course, has not raised as much a cry, you know, as it has, let's say, in other parts of the world. Before that, we had the First Civil War from 1955 to 1972. 1 million people died. So if you put those numbers together, 3 million people in southern Sudan died because of the war to maintain the territorial integrity of the Sudan. That, for southerners, is not worth those lives. And many southerners will feel that if Yugoslavia can be broken into five republics, Russia, the most powerful Soviet republic, Soviet Union can be broken into 15 republics without losing that number of people, why then would the territorial integrity of the Sudan be worth the 3 million lives? I think these are some of the key questions that we, southerners ask. Is it worth that? Something that was constructed by colonialists, by the British and Egyptian colonial power, that we should maintain that territorial integrity. So, secession is a possibility. And in fact, one of the negotiators in the initial stages of this negotiation has come out just recently that let the northerners, particularly those who call themselves Muslims, not fool themselves that the South can be bought, to maintain this national territorial integrity. It cannot be bought because people feel the pain that have been inflicted, for 38 years. So when late John Garang said he has done his work, this was in our last conversation, he has done, in fact, what was necessary for the South, and now it is up to the South, up to Southern Sudan, to do for itself what it wants. I think the late John Garang was referring to this article in the agreement about the referendum on secession. The South-South dialogue is based on the fact that the Khartoum regime has been very successful in splitting the South. That is what they call the Southern Sudan Defense Forces, which was created by the Khartoum regime. And in fact, it is stationed in the oil region. This group that has been killing the people in the oil region, namely the ones who are the rank and file, actually, the ones who carry out the actual murdering of the Nuer people in particular. And they are formed out of the Nuer group. The Nuer group is perhaps the second largest ethnic group in southern Sudan. What the SPLM wants to do is that to bring these people together into the fold of southern Sudan. So the dialogue really, the South-South dialogue, is to bring those who have been used by the Khartoum regime, the divide and conquer strategy, to bring them together so that there is a united Sudan. There are very good indications that even though the late John Garang tried to bring these groups together, failed with one particular group, the Southern Sudan Defense Force, that did not work. That group now is indicating that it is willing to work with Salva Kiir. So this is the idea that the South must be united. You must bring those who have been exploited, used by the Khartoum regime, together. Oil became an important factor in 1977, when it was actually discovered by the Chevron, U.S. Chevron company. Because of the war that started in 1983, Chevron could not be able to exploit the oil, having invested $1 billion. So from 84, when SPLA attacked the Chevron installations in the oil area, Chevron pulled out and was trying to wait until you know, the war ended, but the war never ended. So China came in 1997, 98, and began to work with the regime, you know, to restart the exploitation of this oil. And China, in fact, succeeded in doing that. What it did, of course, was to make sure that there was a cordon around the oil area, namely protection of the area. And they invited, or they got together with a Canadian company called Talisman. Talisman became very important in providing the capital. You know, it was able to raise money in the, what I call the stock market, the financial market in the U.S., and also technology. It was able to get a technology. So the Chinese provided the labor, and as well as weapons, of course, for the Sudanese, the regime military, to protect this area. And this is when, again, it is important to make this connection. This is when they created this, what I call militias. Militias from the north, militias from the south, intended basically to protect the oil region. And they succeeded in doing that. In 1 year, China built a pipeline from Bentiu in southern Sudan to Port Sudan, 990 miles. You know, just in 1 year it was finished, this oil pipeline. And in 1999, the oil began to flow from southern Sudan to the world market, and specifically to China, Malaysia, and of course Talisman. Talisman, the Canadian company, provided enormous military, what I call, assistance to the regime in that oil region. It built an airport where it was used for landing helicopters to attack, you know, SPLA soldiers as well as civilians. Again, in that region, a lot of people lost their lives. I mean, thousands of people were killed, thousands were displaced, okay, in order to secure that oil. Now, the oil became important for China because, as most of you know, China is going through a tremendous industrialization. I was just there for 10 days in China. And it is, I mean, I haven't seen that kind of construction taking place in the world. In fact, they say China is using all the resources in the world now. It is the number one consumer of resources in the world, including oil. But U.S. is still the number one in consumption of oil. China is the consumer of all natural resources now, number one in the world. So oil has become very important. And in this civil war, you know, I mean, the conflict in the Sudan, the Chinese are not only getting oil, but they are also selling weapons to the regime in order to keep this regime in power. Just while I was going, you know, to visit China, they signed a military agreement, you know, between the regime in the Sudan and China, that they are going to have military cooperation. Now, this is something which, given the comprehensive agreement, I think is really out of out of line. Now, would sign an agreement with this region, you know, to have military cooperation. So let me just tell you how important the oil is to China and to other Asian countries. China has 40% of the oil that is being exploited in the Sudan. Malaysia has 30%. Malaysia is a Muslim country, has very good relations with the regime. India, 25% for India. Okay? Now, you put that together, that's 95% controlled by these three Asian countries. Sudan, the owner of the oil, has 5%. So you can see the extent to which the regime, in fact, has mortgaged. I mean, I call it mortgaging, in fact, the country's resources to this country in order to maintain itself in power.
And keep itself in power by any means is how these guys operate. It's what they believe in. It's how they exist. And the exploitation of the masses on issues of their worldview, identity, belief system is how these demons know all too well how to manipulate. In 1822, slavers in the Sudan came south and captured 30,000 black slaves. Slavery in the Sudan was outlawed in 1898. In 1899, the British conquered Sudan. It had first been conquered, as we know, by Arabs over the black indigenous population. The British then formed a condominium with Egypt, which was basically Egypt-British colonial alignment over the state of the Sudan. The first civil war took place in 1955. Fighting intensified in 1960 from the North's attempts at Arabicization. In 1972, the Yeremi, who seized power in 1969, agreed to grant the South some autonomy. But in 83, the Yeremi divided the South into three separate regions, abrogating the 1972 agreement. And the Yeremi unilaterally imposed Islamic law on the whole of the country in September of 1983, creating war ferment. After years of chaos, many people saw the Sudan just imploding, and it was set to be a peace agreement. Al-Bashir, the current president, who was trained in typical fashion, trained in Egypt and the United States of America, Sam's plantation, took over in a coup in June of 1989. The coup preempted the July 4th, 1989 plans for peace conference that were going to be on September 18th of 89. The NIF was vehemently against the non-Islam South, the people of that region having a voice on running the country. Bashir, the NIF, formed a Revolutionary Command Council. They banned all political parties, trade unions, free press, imprisoned political opponents. They fired 20,000 governmental employees, including army officers, judges, university teachers. The workers were all replaced by NIF members and surrogates. You have what is often called a consolidation of underdevelopment in the Sudan. And that is basically a process where the elite clique, who have economic control and power, who have dominance over the economy, banking, the building material, transportation, and media systems, know that creating an Islamic state over the whole of the population is part of them keeping control in a perpetual war over the masses. This is how the game is truly played out in Sudan by one of Abraham's children. We're currently seeing how Abraham's other two children, the Israelis, are playing their game out, and how Sam, the Christian, is acting all over the world. The question is, when are the slaves going to take matters into their own hands and destiny and put these imperialist devourers of the world in their place. Until the next time.